Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. I'm John Vogel, TW's Creative Director. For this episode, I interviewed author Mary Carol Moore this past November. Mary led a long career as a food and cookbook writer before venturing into writing instruction and self-releasing Your Book Starts Here in 2011. Before there was writing, though, there was painting, her first creative outlet. In her third and newest novel, Last Bets, a painter named Ellie travels to a Caribbean island to complete a contract, hopefully bringing her out of a precarious financial situation. Ellie has a light touch of premonition, which she channels into her painting and her nighttime backgammon games for money. In our interview, we talk about the book, but also about the process of publishing, and how to tell your story surrounding your work. Mary shares some of her experiences with agents, publishing versus self-publishing, and how working with her PR mentor, Dan Blank, helped her to connect with her readers. To start off with, just asking a few questions about Last Bets, your newest book. I had been reading the book with the interpretation of you more as a writer, and then I just realized that you also have been a painter throughout your life as well. So that which made more sense with the character of Ellie being a painter. So, but first, I wanted to ask about your relationship between work and art, because Ellie, in the book, the main character, worked, and then she said she got like so much work as like artistic work, and so many commissions that she had to quit her teaching jobs and stuff like that and move into the arts. And then she was at a place in the book where she was like trying to figure out how to, you know, make the transition back to work, basically. I just wanted to know your personal experience as a painter and writer and with paid work outside of the craft. Like, what does that look like for you?
Well, I don't know if I'm in a majority or a minority in believing this, but I always think that artists do better if they have extra work. Otherwise, they are depending on their inspiration and their craft to fuel their lives. And it's really hard for that kind of pressure to exist in an artistic lifestyle. So I've always had something else I did, you know, to put money in the bank. You know, it was wonderful if my books or my paintings did well, which they have and they haven't. You know, it's a fluctuating thing. So I teach, that's the job, my, you know, real job, and also coaching writers. And as an editor, I worked as an editor for 2 decades, freelance for different publishers. So I always had that in my back pocket, because I didn't want to put the pressure on my painting or my writing to like get it done so I can earn money from it. I always wanted to take my time and do it the way I wanted to. So that's my view. Not everybody feels that way, but that's the way I've done it.
Well, I've sort of been in the same, in a hybrid my whole adult life of like working just enough to keep things afloat while trying to maintain a healthy time period to work on my art. So I've kind of worked in the same way, except for the last like 6 years where I've been a stay-at-home dad and been mostly focused on talking writing and my art. Talking writing is also, you know, somewhat of a job, so it is fulfilling that side of things too.
I do think that there's a challenge though sometimes making time for the art, because the work can take over, and so it's like it takes really keen discipline at least in my life to set aside enough time. And I usually found myself doing it early on in the morning before I started working on other people's manuscripts, because otherwise their words would flavor mine. I'd lose the trail of my story thinking about their story, and I never wanted that to happen. So I always said, okay, do my writing first, you know, put in my hours, and then I could work on my work. So luckily I was at home, like kind of like you are, you know, working from home, you can make your own hours. So that worked out for me. Otherwise, I think I wouldn't have done it. I would have been too tired after a day of working on manuscripts to actually sit down with my characters.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge thing that a lot of people go through. I mean, so just speaking of income with from your art, I mean, because your books have like in a lot of cases sold pretty well. So like, you know, I usually like to bring up a sort of reality check of real talk about like what it means when art does do well, because the payoff isn't like, it's still not the same as a regular job. It's like getting paid hourly, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I yeah. What's been your experience with how your books have done and what that has meant for in your personal life? Like, what sort of impact did it have on your life?
That's a good question. All of my books have sold well, and some of them are still selling, 10 or 15 years later. So that's cool. But that told me that books have a long lifetime, and I'm not gonna really count on them out of the gate doing incredibly well because I'm not that kind of writer. My last two novels are bestsellers on Amazon, which means that in pre-orders they ranked high, into the hot new release or number one category on Amazon. But that doesn't mean long term they still sell really well. They're just over time, like my book on writing, it sold well like within the first 2 years, and then it's just kept like this steady, slow income for me. So I don't really count it up and say, well, this book has a profit and loss statement of this and this. I don't do it that way. But I think overall, I've paid back my time. I've paid back my costs, like hiring an editor or hiring another kind of input. Like I've hired a coach sometimes for marketing because I really have no idea how to do that. Or this podcast tour that I'm on now, I had hired somebody to help me with that, a publicist. So I have all those expenses, and then I have to factor in how much the book earns. But it's going to be like, I think the last book's going to take another couple of years before it pays back some of the costs that I spent. And then it'll just keep earning straightforwardly. So I'm okay with that. I really am. I think it's a cool way to do it, and that keeps me free to do the art I want to do rather than the art that's going to pay. It's just a different approach.
Yeah, and it doesn't make you modify your art
Right.
to chase the sales,
Right.
which is like a I would say is a goal of, you know, to be free of that sort of tension.
I think so. I mean, especially as a painter, because I do both. I've done commissions quite a lot for people. That means that they see something they like of mine and they want it slightly different colors, or they want it larger for their. Somebody said in California, said, I want this painting, but like four times as big for my breakfast room. So I thought, okay, well, sure, I can do that. So, that's a definite doing it for the money thing. But at the same time, I've already created the painting and it's done out of my heart, and out of my inspiration and not necessarily to sell. So I figure I'm lucky if people ask me to do stuff for money as a painter. But I never put that kind of pressure on myself. I really can't, because otherwise I don't know, maybe others don't have this, but I get stuck. I get really like kind of self-guessing, guess second guessing, is it called? Yeah, second guessing myself. I don't like it.
In the book, you have a lot of references to painting what someone's supposed to be. So when in the book, Ellie in painting portraits and then sort of shadow coaching Rosie to paint portraits, there's this, you know, common theme that keeps coming up of painting somebody not just as they are, but also like their potential in some way. So yeah, I wanted to know, like, unpack that a little bit more, and also see if you had something in there that translates to writing, like the same idea translated to writing, if you could think about it that way. But yeah, just in the painting first, and then that.
Okay. Well, the idea for Ellie being able to see the future of her subjects came a long, long ago when I read a sci-fi book called The Adept, and it was about a portrait painter in England that was able to see the death of the people that he painted, and it just freaked him out so much he couldn't paint anymore. And I was really intrigued by that idea. So years later, when I was working on this book, I thought, well, I want Ellie to have some kind of a paranormal talent, something that she is going to get in trouble for later in the story, which she does. And I want it to come out in her art as a kind of a love-hate thing. Like, she loves to paint, but she hates the visions that come as she's painting of the people. And yet she's driven to portray them in a certain way that's true to for her, you know, the way that she sees them be potentially able to be, like a really, you know, a criminal guy that has a good heart. That's a cliche, but she's like driven to put that on the painting. And yet at the same time, it's gotten her in so much trouble. And this is a part of herself that she's tried to kind of keep under a trap door her whole life. So I was really intrigued by that idea that, you know, painters see the world differently. And what if I pushed that? What if I made it like not just differently, like we see color and shape differently, but we actually see beyond the surface of what people are presenting. And so that was kind of the impetus for writing the novel, is to explore that aspect of painting. Like, what is seeing actually? What does it mean to be a painter who sees? So if I was going to translate that into writing, that's a really interesting question. I don't know how I would do it. I would probably look at like what's behind things. See if how much of the, I call it the inner story. When I'm teaching writing, I call it the outer story and the inner story. If the inner story is the thing that the person perceives all the time, what do they do with that? So a character could possibly be someone that would constantly be looking for the story behind the story. I don't know if that's the direction of your question, John, but that was kind of what I got to say in response.
Which is funny, because I feel like I am always trying to read, thinking about like, what is this saying about the author? Where are the autobiographical nuggets, which are sometimes misidentified? But yeah. You know, what are the where are the sections where like I feel like this person is talking about themselves in some way? Like, I'm always reading in that way as well. But I guess the other thing that comes to mind to me also is like, a lot of times when you're writing, a lot of people say that good art in some way is supposed to be like real life, but more true, you know? It's almost like there's a more generalized emotional aspect of the story that is more than what happens in real life that people can identify with, I guess.
I guess that's true too. Yeah. I always found that it was important for artists, writers, or whatever, anybody who has creative expression, to basically share their truth with the world in the way they see it. So that's kind of like what you're saying, you know, the whole idea, the power of art is to share that truth behind what, you know, we go through every day, right? Behind the ordinary world, the artist sees something a little more extraordinary. And that's what our job is to bring that out. So that's kind of what, in all my books, I look for something like that. You know, I don't necessarily have it when I start to sit down and write the book, but as it develops and as the characters evolve, I start to get a glimpse of what their inner meaning would be, what their message is to me, what I'm supposed to learn from the writing, and then what I want the reader to pick up too.
What are the connections and differences between writing and painting, just more generally, like not specific to the seeing something that's not there, but like, and I guess it, more so in your life, how have they interplayed? Because I know you started writing later, I think on your about page, it said at 50. What has been your trajectory with each art and how have they like sort of interacted with each other?
That's a good question too. I started out as a painter when I was a kid, and in my young adult years, I went to art school and was really into it. And then realized, I don't know, maybe practical streak, I realized that I wasn't going to be able to make a living off of it and wasn't about to go back home and live with my parents. And, you know, I was really wanting to be independent, so I had to find something that I could do that would be more self-sufficient, self-sustaining. And I had lived abroad. I'd lived in France, so I'd studied cooking there. And when I came back to the States, I had graduated from school and everything, and I went to live in the Southwest in Arizona. I worked as a cook on a ranch, and then I started teaching cooking classes, and then that led to writing a column for the local monthly magazine about cooking, and then that led to opening a cooking school in the Bay Area, and that led to getting asked to write a syndicated column for the LA Times Syndicate, and working with the California Culinary Academy on cookbooks. And so it was kind of serendipitous. The art went kind of into the background as I started to develop my writing. And I realized I can do both of them, but I can't do both of them as a career. I couldn't push both of them to be my career and my working life. So I decided I'd use the writing to be my working life, and that really did well for a while. Teaching and writing was a lucrative job. I was a really I was kind of the top of my game as a food journalist in that time. But I realized what was missing. I had cancer in my 50s, and I had to kind of face what I hadn't done in my life, and that was the art was the thing. So then I went back to art, and I started to try to toggle between the two of them. And I think this is more closely ans to answer your question. I find they support each other because I'll get stuck in one. I'll get stuck in my story, figuring out a scene or a character. And so I'll stop and I'll actually go to the painting and work on the painting for a while. And what it, I guess, from a brain point of view, it switches me into the right brain, the non-linguistic or linear brain, and I get to dream images for a while, and then I can take those images back to my writing, and the image almost always starts me off with something that fuels a scene. Like in one of my books, in Last Bets, the ones you're talking about, the image of Ellie painting and seeing the figure of the person ahead of her, the person she's painting, morph. And seeing like a different face and different clothing and different hair come to her. And that image came to me as I was painting, and I was looking at something. I was thinking, oh, how real is this that I'm seeing? Is it really what's there? And so then that took me into the story. So I don't know if that makes sense, but the two of them inform each other. And I can sustain each one by going back to the other. So I switch, it's like switching screens on the computer. I just toggle back and forth between the two of them, and it seems to work really well, really well.
Are you familiar? I just started The Artist's Way by
Oh,
Julia Cameron on my brother's recommendation. And she talks a lot about doing basically to unblock your writing, doing mundane tasks that involve images in order to activate your artist brain so that you can go back to the writing with those images. It just really aligned with what you're saying. So
Yeah, I
yeah.
love the Artist's Way. I've run through that course. I've taught that course. I've done so much. I still do morning pages, 25 years later. So I really believe in what she's saying, and I think that's probably where I unconsciously got trained. My art teachers also said this. They said, some people in their studios, they'll have two easels up, and they've got two paintings going at the same time, and they move back and forth between them in order not to get stuck, because your eye can get fixated on something. You can get blocked, and it's the same exact thing with writing. You can get so blocked you can't see what you're doing. You start to repeat yourself. So when I find myself starting to repeat, using things I already know too well, no exploration left, no adventure in me, then I know it's time to switch. So then I'll go and, like Cameron says, you refresh my art brain by going to the other thing, whatever it is, the art or the writing. And it does work. It really does. It doesn't take long sometimes, a few hours or even less, and I'm back to thinking about my story and where I was stuck, and oh yeah, this image came through while I was painting. So it's very cool, I think. A very interesting way to approach creating things.
Yeah, and I know as a musician, I also oftentimes will have two different projects. One that's in a late stage where I'm like working on it more front brain and just thinking about it and evaluating and like revising and polishing. And then I'll have another, sometimes I'll start a different project during that phase just to have something fun to do at the end of the night, you know, to sort of as like a stress release that then allows me to like reapproach the further along one the next day with like a fresh brain.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly it. And I think if more artists did this, I don't know, I'm just on a little crusade about it right now, but I used to tell my students, you know, make sure you have more than one thing going. Even if it's like, oh, I don't know, cooking or something, or gardening or taking a walk every day or something that you do that's going to get you out of that fixation with your art so that you can relax your brain and start to receive images and ideas. And oftentimes your best ideas come then. I take my phone when I go walk every day. I take my phone along, you know, and I'm often going like, oh yeah, this cool idea came for a line of dialogue, so I'll turn on my voice memos and record it, you know, but it comes because I'm not focused on the piece. I'm doing something completely different.
In the artist's way, and I've been sort of obsessing about this, partially because I have maintained like an artistic practice throughout my adulthood, but I keep running into these stories over and over again of people who get stuck in their work life and in their real life in usually later into adulthood or middle age. And I'm thinking of Julia Cameron said she goes through this. She went through this, and she also had like a lot of students who went through this who are like first discovering their creative side later in life. And I also think of Brené Brown, who got to a certain point, I think in her 40s or something like that, where she made a life switch and started studying shame. That was like her, and she calls it like a nervous breakdown. And realized at that time that it was that she needed to start pursuing some sort of creative endeavor because she was finding that the people that she aspired to be like all had a creative endeavor. So I wonder, like, just what are your feelings, experiences in your personal life, and also what you've seen with other people of sort of the idea of repressing, of society's way of repressing our artistic drives in the service of like practical paid work.
I have a really direct experience that may not apply to a lot of your listeners, but so I was really, as I said, I was really at the top of my game as a food journalist. I had won all these awards, and I was LA Times Syndicate writer every week, 86 newspapers around my column, and I had all these books. I had 10 books published. And then I got cancer at age 49, I think it was, late 40s, and like I said, it calls you to stop, you know, when you have a serious illness or trauma or something happens, death of somebody, or you know, even a really dramatic move to a different place, it causes you to stop and kind of reevaluate what you'd done so far and what's missing. And for me, the art was missing. So I went through treatment, and I got, you know, hours, days, weeks in bed after chemo treatments, and just had a lot of thinking to do about what I wanted to do. And I don't know, you know, I can't equate myself with Brené Brown. She's one of my heroes, but it was like that feeling of coming to a place where I had to break what I've done before. And I ended up deciding what was missing in my life was fiction, writing fiction, because I'd always wanted to write fiction, and art, painting. So I you know, age 50, I decided to stop my food career. It was really a lucrative career. I was combining, you know, I was pretty envied by people that I knew because I was combining an art form, which was writing, with a really well-paying job because I was being paid by different companies to create books for them, cookbooks like Prevention Magazine. I don't know if you know them. Rodale Press hired me for a bunch of books, and you know, people like that. So it was a really exciting time for me, but I had gotten to the point where I was, again, repeating myself. I was doing stuff I already knew how to do really well. And that's almost indicative of a breaking point coming oftentimes when you get into that groove where everything is familiar and nothing will surprise you anymore. The art kind of leaks out, the surprise element of the art. So I quit my food career. I finished my contracts with the publishers and I used my savings to go back to school for an MFA in fiction. And that was like age 50, right? So I was the oldest person in the classroom and it was really hard to be a beginner again since I'd been published for almost two decades already. And it was, I had to learn a completely new language with fiction. And at the same time, I decided I'd do painting because, you know, I wasn't making money at that time. I was just living off savings and I could do whatever I wanted. So I was working on my MFA and then painting. And both of those things brought me, you know, I'm going to sound a little melodramatic here, but I think it helped me heal from the cancer because I think the cancer, for me at least, was a wake-up call that I was really not doing what I needed to do in my life. I was doing everything that society and everybody around me thought was just like the ideal, but it wasn't coming from my heart. So I really believe that there's a crisis point, you know, a turning point for a lot of people in their lives where they realize, you know, they haven't done what they came to do and they really have an awareness of that now. And what are they going to do about it? Are they going to take the leap and big risk? Because you lose stuff, you know, you lose the comfort and the safety and the security. But I mean, for me, the payoff was huge and it still is. I have no regrets for what I did. And I've been lucky. My fiction, my first book got picked up by a publisher a year after I graduated from my MFA. And that was really a cool thing. And then that led to three more books. So I was lucky, right? But it still was worth it. Even if that hadn't happened, I felt like I did what I was called to do, I came for.
A lot of times in talking writing, we like to talk about like self-publishing and the whole and just the experience of trying to be an independent artist because you know, a lot of, I feel like a lot of our listeners and also a lot of people on the team who have worked with talking writing have all been like independent artists of some sort. So yeah, what has your experience been, because your books are self-published, correct? The recent ones,
yeah.
Yeah, the recent ones.
When I started out, I had an agent, and I have had three agents in my career, and the first one, you know, I sold all my books to traditional publishers, so I had a whole run of like 10, 11 of my books were traditionally published. Most of them agented, a few not. Few I sold myself to small presses. So I had a really long history with traditional publishing. There was a lot of pros and cons with it. I mean, I think maybe the pros were for a new writer. When I started out, I was, you know, just in my early 30s, the first book I published. It was important for me to have that kind of handholding because I remember the agent was able to go through the contract from the publisher and find a lot of problems and correct them. And the distribution was really good with the publishers. So it was good for me to have that experience. And then as a teacher and a coach, I could come to people with that background and talk about what it was like to work with an agent and work with traditional publishers and contracts and all of that, rights. But when I was in, when my first novel got published by a traditional publisher, but I didn't have an agent for that because my agent had retired. Then there was a time that I decided, I wrote a book on writing called Your Book Starts Here, and I was trying to get an agent again, and I found the industry had changed so much. It was so hard to get an agent. I had a couple of people really interested, and one of them said, if this was a cookbook, I'd snap you up right away, you know, because I had that huge history, but they weren't willing to take a gamble on a book about writing. So I self-published that one, and that was back in 2011, and it ended up winning the New Hampshire Literary Award, and it sold really well, paid back all my costs, everything, still sells well. So I got really encouraged by that. But at the same time, I really wanted to see if I could get an agent again. And I ended up submitting to, I think, 40 agents' queries for my second novel. And I finally got a signer for that, a woman who I worked with for about 3 or 4 years. I really liked her. She was unable to sell my second novel. There were problems with it, and luckily the publishers gave me huge feedback, and so I was able to take that feedback and go in and kind of correct the book. And then I decided I'm going to self-publish this, and I found I knew from my traditional publishing experience, and this is one of its benefits for me, I needed to have a really slick professional job in order to compete in the industry. So it's not like you can, if you're interested in indie publishing, you can't just like print it out of your basement on your computer, on your printer or anything like that and bind it. You have to really go for the editing and the proofreading and the cover design and all the legal parts, the copyright and Library of Congress if you want that, and all of the things that I think are put into a traditionally published book. And then I believe now, based on my experience, I self-published now these two novels. I believe that they're doing as well as any of my other books, and they look as good. A Woman's Guide to Self and Search and Rescue has won 4 awards in the last year, and Last Bets is going to be it's got a huge award coming up. I can't talk about yet. It's going to be revealed in December by the award winner, award company. But like, I think there's no downside to it, but I do believe that if someone's new to indie publishing and they don't have any traditional publishing experience, they need to get coached, because you really have to know the industry and know kind of how to put a book together and what you can't shortcut. And so that's my long answer to your question, John, but I have really strong opinions about poorly put together books with a lot of typos and just terrible layout inside and bad covers. Nobody's going to really want them as much. They're not going to be attractive when there's so many beautiful books out there. So that's something to think about too.
And this next question kind of goes along with the self-publishing, but because the other side that I know I struggle with as an independent artist is the marketing side of putting out books, which is oftentimes something that artists aren't the best at, and maybe even like heavily resistant to. So, and I know you mentioned in your acknowledgments that you worked with Dan Blank, who mm-hmm. is a Substacker, and I know he's got a big following on Substack, and he's very much of a connection-based PR ideology person. Yeah. So, if you could describe your work with him, and also how your approach and your experience with PR and trying to, and if you've had any of those same blocks of like not wanting to market yourself, which I think is the big thing that a lot of people have problems with.
I think Catherine May, who's a memoirist I really admire, she said it's really naive now, foolish, she said, to believe that we can't self-promote, that we really have to self-promote if we're publishing, no matter whether you're going traditional or you're going indie. You have to be willing to get your book out there, because readers can't find you otherwise. You have to be willing to share your work, and with your work you have to share your story, your own reason for writing the book, your own journey. People are buying books a lot not just based on the story, but they want to know the person behind the story. That's what we're finding, and that's what Dan taught me. I came into this new, you know, I had published traditionally up to this point, and I had this book that my agent couldn't sell, And I realized if I wanted to do well by it, if I wanted to do all the things I really wanted to do with all the other books that the publisher didn't back, you know, some of them put me on a book tour and did marketing, and but a lot of it was on me. You know, I got myself on radio shows, and I got myself in articles and magazines, and I got myself online in podcasts. It wasn't done by the publisher, and that's really common unless you're top of list. So I knew that I needed to not only learn publicity and marketing better, but I wanted to find out what was different about it now. I know it's a new era. I know publishing's changed, and I had a feeling marketing had too. So I had followed Dan for about 2 years on his newsletter, even before he moved to Substack. And I really liked his human-centered approach. It was much different than other publicists I'd worked with, you know, when I was with a publishing house, they'd assign me a publicist. It was really different, Dan's whole approach. So I talked to him and we clicked, and I decided I'd go ahead and hire him for my first book, The Women's Guide to Search and Rescue. That was the first indie one, that novel. And I decided to basically become a student of marketing because he knew so much. I mean, he'd been doing it for years, not just for his clients, but for big companies and publishers and everything. So I just took this crash course from him for 6 months, and I loved it. It was hard work. You know, I had to reconfigure my entire belief system. And what you were talking about, John, the resistance that's in people, the artist's resistance to marketing their work. We somehow have this belief that all we have to do is create the work, and then we can go hide back in our studio or our writing room and the work will do it for us. And that's so not true today. It used to be perhaps, but it's not true now. Very rare is someone rescued or found without any marketing behind them. Mm-hmm. So I knew that Dan could teach me a lot. And so he basically took me on this, the course that he works with his clients and learning about how to share myself authentically. That's the thing I didn't know how to do. I thought you had to be slick and an expert and know it all and not reveal all the, you know, warts in your background and anything like that. But he wanted me to help find the story. He wanted to help me find the story I wanted to tell about my own journey as a writer and artist. And that's the thing that I learned the most from him. He was great. There are other people that do this too, but, you know, I happened to find him, and he was the one that he actually, this was really funny. So A Woman's Guide to Search and Rescue, which is the book before Last Bets. Mm-hmm. It's about two women pilots. And my mother was a pilot. She was a pilot in World War II. And she flew bombers, and she was really like an amazing person. And I knew I wrote the book because I wanted to honor her. I wanted to remember her and understand her better. And I said to Dan, you know, this is really a book about my love for my mom and my questions that she never answered before she died and what it was like to be a pilot. And he said, well, why don't you take flying lessons? And I practically fell off my chair because my mom had always said she'd teach me, but she couldn't. You know, she had four kids and a full-time job. So I was turning 70 that year the book was published, and I decided, what the heck, I'm going to go sign up for flying lessons. And I did. I went down to the local airport. I found an instructor and I signed up, and I went, he put me in the cockpit the first day. So it's that kind of thing that, and Dan, I told Dan, he goes, you didn't, you really did. I said, yes, I follow your advice exactly. But what it did for me was it transformed me inside. You know, I suddenly understood my mom, what it was like to be in a plane, what it was like to be a woman and a pilot, and, you know, in a cockpit and pilot seat. And a lot of things kind of clicked for me after that. And I was able to authentically talk about the book in a huge, hugely different way because of that one experience that Dan had provoked. So that's an example of how a good marketing person who really understands the kind of the inner story behind marketing, the reasons we do it, not just to sell books, but to really connect with people, connect with readers of like mind. He's one of the best at that, and that's what I learned from him.
I think it's very helpful for artists to hear the stories of other people and how they are navigating that. Partially also just to give people like a heads up about the amount of, about how you have to, like the amount of work that goes into something like that, or yeah. Like the hurdles that, you know, I feel like there's not a huge amount of real talk out there about the experience of trying to be an independent artist, create art, and market yourself at the same time. And practical stories that help people emotionally get through that.
It's really hard. We want to separate the two. We do. Mm-hmm. As artists, we want to not have our lives and our art be together in the public view. We want to keep our lives private and our art to be the thing that speaks for us. But not today. Today, who's behind the art is really important to readers and viewers and probably listeners. I mean, when I like a band, I go back into the internet and check them out, you know? What are they like? What are their private lives like? And what do they believe? And what are their politics and all that? So it's normal right now. We're into what's happening in the background of people's lives. I think it's pure curiosity about other humans, because we're all struggling, you know? We want to learn how to do it better, so...
I mean, also there's this is a huge thing with music, but I mean, with all art, these days it's more and more common for the purchasing of art to be completely optional. Like, you don't need to purchase the supporting of the artist is, not built into the exchange. Right. So, so if you want to get people to support you, like, one of the only ways to do it is to let them know who they're supporting and to give them a reason to want to support you over other people. I mean, otherwise they can just listen to you on Spotify and not pay you at all. You know, it's a...
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I know that happens on Substack. You know, mentioned Dan was on Substack. I have a newsletter on Substack. I've written it every Friday for like 16 years or something. And Substack is interesting because you can set up any kind of free newsletter you want and run it as long as you want. But you also have the option of asking for paid subscriptions. So after about a year, you know, I said, okay, I'm going to try this, because I had people reading that newsletter for the whole time that I've been publishing it. And they kept, every now and then they'd email me and they'd say, you know, how can I support you to keep doing this? This is really important to me. So I thought, wow, this is kind of what you're talking about. You know, really supporting an artist to keep doing what they're doing is a very positive step in the society, I think. It, you know, whether it's crowdfunding or whatever you do to support artists, buying their stuff, of course, but, you know, a subscription to their newsletter is another way. And I think it's great. I try to support artists as much as I can, because even musicians, I don't just download stuff. I try to pay for it if I can, but... It's important, I think. How else are artists going to survive? And they're like the important, most important element in our society, in my view.
To me, I have like a very firm ideology that art is worth doing whether you get paid for it or not. And I also like firmly believe in the connection principle of PR, but I also get into, you know, it doesn't keep me from being... like jealous or wanting more money or wanting more attention, you know? What's your experience been like with that? I mean, because to me, I almost always have like two competing emotions happening at the same time of wanting to do this for the love, but also wanting the extra, you know, wanting something more out of it. Is that something that you can relate to?
Totally.
Yeah. How have you navigated it?
Well, I was gonna go back to Julia Cameron, since you're working with Artist's Way. There's a jealousy map in there. One of the exercises is called the jealousy map, and I've run it so many times for myself. So basically, what you do is you list 10 people that you're envious of in your art or whatever, your life, and you write down why, you know, what do they do that's gotten so much acclaim, or maybe they're really talented at something that you wish you were. And then she has you do something really interesting. She has you, I think, ask for one thing that you could do to get closer to that talent yourself. And I did this jealousy map so many times when I was a kind of trying so hard to get published early on. And I found myself envying so many people and what they had done. I didn't know that they had struggled just like me. that they had risen through the ranks and they had worked really hard and they had sacrificed and they had risked. So their ability to stay with it was the thing that I actually ended up envying, that they'll stay with it no matter how successful and how fastly successful they are. If they're successful really slowly, they still are staying with it. Like if you read some, there's some sites that show the number of rejections that some famous books have gotten. I mean, Harry Potter was turned down by 9 publishers before it got snapped up. And I think there's a woman named Kate DeCamillo who wrote Because of Winn-Dixie, which is a young adult novel that got turned into a film. I think she got 397 rejections before that book was picked up. So, you know, when you know that, the behind the scenes stuff about people, then you don't think that they've gotten some kind of luck or magic that you don't have. And it's actually a quality that you, you know, I'm saying you like me, I could actually spend time on. I could actually develop my strength and persistence and stick it out and know that, oh gosh, before I got my recent agent, that I had to go through 40 rejections. And my students would sometimes say to me, well, I've sent my manuscript to 5 agents and they've all said, no, I think I'm going to give up. And I think, boy, you're about 1/9 of the way there. You know, you haven't even touched the next level. Keep going. But having that persistence was something that I had to learn. And it came from, I think I can credit Julia Cameron's Jealousy Map for that. So that was a really very cool exercise to try, but I totally relate. I think most artists have been there. I mean, nobody's got a magic ride in this.
Well, those are all my questions. Do you have anything that you would like to leave our listeners with or anything, or if you have anything that you would like to add?
Well, the only thing that I would add is that it's never too late. So if you're thinking of trying something, trying a book idea or trying anything, any kind of artistic expression, a song or, you know, a poem, whatever you like, you know, whatever really is in your heart and you really want to do, it's never too late. And I, you know, I've just published my 15th book at age 70 and I took my first flying lessons and I'm not going to stop yet, you know? So maybe that's encouraging to some of you who are, feeling like life has kind of put you in a box and you can't really see your way to becoming the artist that you really want to be, the writer that you really want to be, but keep going because it's never too late.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.